Hello everyone. I'm currently in London today attending a leadership and development session with Visionary at NCVO. Alongside other charity leaders from across the country, it's been a really valuable opportunity to share ideas, discuss the future of services within the Sightless sector, and reflect on how we continue strengthening support for our local island community here at Sight for White. While I'm away, there's still plenty happening, including the release of our newly refreshed newsletter. Many of you should be receiving it very soon, and I really hope this new iteration is well received. We've worked really hard to make sure it was more sustainable, accessible, community focused, and cost effective, of course, while still keeping the warmth, updates, stories, and opportunities that our members enjoy reading each quarter. Inside, you'll also find information about our upcoming Christmas in July event, which we're all very excited about. There's games, refreshments, music, stalls and raffles, festive fun, and plenty of opportunities to come together socially. I also want to say a sincere thank you to everyone who continues to support us at Sight for White. As always, please keep an eye out for our upcoming activities, our groups, social opportunities and awareness events over the summer months. And as always, I look forward to seeing as many of you as possible very, very soon. Take care.
Here is this week's charity news, 22nd of May, 2026. We are once again providing refreshments at this weekend's open studio at Gurnard Village Hall between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday. If you would like tea and homemade cake, please pop by and enjoy whilst raising funds for the charity.
JD will be at Bembridge Street Fair on Monday, promoting the charity and our work. Please pop by and say hello if you are visiting the fair.
Our scarecrow will be on display this week at Chillerton's annual festival. We are displaying ours on the village green. And next Saturday, the 30th, we will be providing refreshments in Aunt Sally's tea room. If you are visiting with friends and family, do not forget to vote for our scarecrow in the competition.
Swimming is not on this Monday due to the bank holiday, but will resume on Monday, the 1st of June.
Tandem biking is now on a Tuesdays along the Cowes cycle track. If you would go on a tandem, please do not hesitate to call the office and we could arrange a suitable time.
Yoga will start on Tuesday, the 2nd of June at Millbrook House at 2 p.m. If you would like to join the group, please call the office and ask for more details.
Coffee and chat is on Wednesday, starting at 10 a.m. until 11:30 a.m. The cost is £2 to include drinks and cake. Staff are on hand to help with any queries and to demonstrate equipment.
Mix and Mingle is on Thursday at Millbrook House. This group enjoys crafts, quizzes and entertainment. If you would like to put your name down on the list, please call the office.
Striders is on Friday the 29th, when the group will be walking around the Shorewell area. The walk is around 5 miles long and lunch will be at the Crown Inn Shorewell. Please call the office for more details.
Walk and Talk is on Friday the 12th of June this month. The walk is between Newchurch and Sandown Golf Club. Please call the office for more details. This is a gentle stroll with tea and cake afterwards.
We have trips on the Spirit of Scott Bader available. This is a catamaran and will sail from East Cowes for half a day or full day sailing in the Solent. For more information, please call the office.
Wet Wheels has once again invited us to go out on their vessel for an exciting ride out on the Solent. The cost is £10 for around 1 hour 45 minutes journey from Cowes Corinthian Yacht Club. The date is the 23rd of July. Please call the office if you wish to go.
We have been invited to the Royal Victoria Yacht Club's Disability Sailing Day on July the 18th between 11 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. Spaces are limited, and if oversubscribed, a ballot will be held. Please call the office if you are interested and would like more details.
Sainsbury's Newport has changed their shop layout following major refurbishment. If anyone would like to book a route familiarization session with Emma, our trainee mobility officer, please call the office and she'll be able to book you in a time.
We are busy planning our Christmas in July event on the 4th of July. We are appealing for good bric-a-brac, tombola prizes, jigsaws, books, raffle prizes, and any Christmas decorations. If you have any donations, please drop them off at Millbrook House, or if you can't, please call the office and we can arrange collection.
This is an urgent appeal to anyone whom you may know that could drive our minibus. We are in desperate need for volunteers to drive it, especially on a Thursday afternoon. If you have a neighbor, friend, relation who may be interested, please ask them to call the office and speak to Susan.
Hi, this is Steve reading a story from Isle of Wight Radio with the headline, Major Road Closures and Traffic Changes Planned Across the Isle of Wight in the Coming Weeks. Motorists across the Isle of Wight are being urged to prepare for a series of road closures, speed restrictions and traffic changes as Island Roads rolls out a wide programme of utility, resurfacing and maintenance works over the coming weeks. The works, announced on Wednesday 20th of May, affect towns and villages across the island, with some restrictions beginning later this month and others continuing into July and beyond. Newport faces one of the busiest schedules of disruption, with closures planned for Long Lane, Medina Way, Eastview, Fairlie Road, Fairlie Link Road, Forest Road and Parkhurst Road. Winchester Close Path will also shut for footway works. A temporary 30 mph speed restriction will be introduced on Yarmouth Road between 29th and 31st of May for the Three Rivers Festival. In Ryde, several roads are set to be affected, including High Street, Lynn Street, Edward Street, Well Street, East Ashy Lane and Marlborough Road. Great Preston Road will also be subject to a temporary 6 foot 6 inch width restriction for up to 15 days between late May and early July. Drivers in Shanklin should expect closures on Atherley Road and Cross Road as maintenance and resurfacing schemes get underway. Broadway and Sandown will close from the 1st of June to the 3rd of June for utility works, while Meadow Way and Royal Street will also be affected later in the programme. In nearby Lake, restrictions are planned on the Fairway and Station approach with James Avenue, Lake Hill, Lee Road, Ranelagh Road and Cliff Way also due to close at various points. Ventnor residents face works on Newport Road in early June, alongside closures on St Albans Road, Shore Road and Leeson Road. Rue Street in Gurnard is due to close for carriageway repairs, while Alverston Road in East Cowes will also shut temporarily. Yarmouth is set for several changes, including closures on St James Street, Quay Street, South Street and High Street. Temporary changes to one-way systems are also planned to maintain access during works. A lengthy programme of maintenance works will affect Freshwater, with Hill Lane, High Street, Heathfield Road and Silcombe Lane all scheduled for closures or traffic changes. The one-way system on High Street will also be temporarily suspended for periods between late May and the 10th of July. Binstead's Church Road, Pitts Lane and Newnham Lane face utility-related closures, whilst Bembridge sees restrictions linked to the annual street fair on the 25th of May. Further works are planned in Shorrel, Thorley, Calburn, Chiel, Godsill, Whitwell, Arreton and Bryston, with drainage, bridge maintenance, carriageway repairs and utility schemes all scheduled. Island Roads says many closures may be only in place for one shift or a handful of days, with exact timings to be communicated through advance warning signs and letters to affected residents. Motorists are being advised to allow extra time for journeys and to check local signage before travelling.
Businesses need more support, Town Council told, amid rise in empty shops. From the Island Echo. We've got more empty shops in Ryde than we had a year ago. That should concern us. That's the message being delivered to Ryde Town Council. The public body was asked how it communicates with Ryde's business community and residents by a member of the public, Paul Wyatt, who suggested creating a panel to find out what firms are up against. He told Ryde Town Council that the town must have a vibrant centre, attract new enterprise and protect existing businesses. Mr. Wyatt said, how does Ryde Town Council communicate with the business community and residents? We're told that the town hall was setting up a new Ryde Business Association. To my knowledge, nothing has happened, which is very sad. You have lots of committees. I would have thought by now we could set up a committee to start making inroads into finding out what businesses are up against and what ideas they've got. It looks like the town board isn't coming up with anything. We've got more empty shops in Ryde than we had a year ago. That should concern us. Outgoing Ryde Mayor Diana Conyers responded, I take your point entirely. You're right, that part of the problem has not been quite knowing what the neighbourhood board is going to do. Before the board came into existence and there was a business association here, there was a representative from the association that was nominated to attend town council meetings. And he was our contact point. And we did engage with him for quite a while. It's all in limbo. Let's hope we get something coming up. Alan Bridges, Business Development Manager at Ryde Town Council, added, I've got a bit of an update on that because I had exactly the same question of the Neighbourhood Board. This week, I asked Pete Fellows, Strategic Manager for the Regeneration Team at the Isle of Wight Council, and they have a presentation going to their comms committee on Tuesday. So at that point, hopefully we should know more. Since the meeting, Chair of the Ryde Neighbourhood Board, Stephen Holbrook, has said his independent partnership is keen to work with local businesses and pointed to the launching of a new initiative, We Love Ryde. Created in response to public feedback and following an open process, We Love Ryde will promote and represent local businesses and help them engage with the board. We want businesses at the heart of future decision making, so please get in touch with your ideas via We Love Ryde when it is launched soon or directly with the board. We Love Ryde is one of the initiatives made possible by our initial capacity funding, which has helped us put the right governance and delivery structures in place. With much of that groundwork complete, we're now moving into the next phase with significant funding, which will be available for local projects. Mr. Holbrook said this includes a community grant scheme offering up to £100,000 this financial year to support local projects. He added that details of the first round will be published shortly and the board welcomes applications from across the community, including local businesses. The RNB was set up as part of the government's plan for neighbourhoods, renamed the Pride in Place programme in September 2025. Earlier this year, the board unveiled a vision to invest £19.5 million of Whitehall funding in Ryde. County Hall acts as the accountable body for the RNB, meaning it is responsible for managing public funds and ensuring compliance with government requirements.
Yarmouth gig growers storm to Hamble River, raid victory. From the Island Echo, read by Joyce. Yarmouth Gig Growing Club celebrated victory at the Hamble River raid after Sea Spirit stormed to first place and narrowly missed the course record by just 1 second. Yarmouth Gig Rowing Club enjoyed a successful outing at the annual Hamble River Raid after claiming victory in the Cornish Pilot Gig Race. The popular rowing event held on the River Hamble features a challenging 7 kilometre course starting at Hamble Quay in South Hampshire before heading upriver and back again. More than 65 craft took part, including kayaks and Cornish pilot gigs, all navigating the busy waterway. Yarmouth entered both of its Cornish pilot gigs, Sea Spirit and Spirit, with mixed crews competing in a field of 8 gig boats. Both crews made strong starts, but it was Sea Spirit that gradually pulled clear of the pack before going on to win convincingly. The crew also recorded the fastest time of any vessel competing on the day, crossing the line in 40 minutes and 1 second, just 1 second outside the course record. Club chairman and race coxswain Keith Campbell said, "This was a very successful day for Yarmouth Gig Rowing Club. Both crews acquitted themselves very well, and for Sea Spirit to not only win the race, but also in a near record time, was very pleasing. This continues a very successful start to the season for the club, having entered 2 regattas and won them both, which for a small club on the Isle of Wight is quite an achievement."
Hello, this is Steve reading a story from the Island Echo with the headline, "Visit Isle of Wight launches new website to support island tourism businesses." Visit Isle of Wight has launched a new industry-focused website aimed at supporting and connecting businesses across the Isle of Wight's tourism and hospitality sector. The new platform, WightBid, has been created as a dedicated online hub for businesses involved in the island's visitor economy, offering access to support, marketing opportunities, industry updates, and resources linked to the Wight BID. The website features information about the Wight BID and how it is administered by Visit Isle of Wight, alongside a business support hub containing workshops, training opportunities, and downloadable materials. There are also sections dedicated to destination marketing campaigns, media and PR opportunities, industry news and advertising options for businesses looking to raise their profile. As previously reported by Island Echo, Visit Isle of Wight says the launch is part of its ongoing efforts to improve communication and engagement with businesses operating within the sector. Dominic Ray, the CEO of Visit Isle of Wight, said, "This website is an important development for the island's visitor economy and for the businesses we represent through the Wight BID. We wanted to create something practical, useful and easy to access. A place where businesses can clearly see what activity is taking place, find support, discover opportunities and better understand how Visit Isle of Wight is working on behalf of the industry." The Isle of Wight has incredibly strong and diverse visitor economy, and this platform gives us a more modern way to connect with businesses, share information, and champion the sector together. This is very much a starting point. The website will continue to grow with more resources, updates, and opportunities added over time. Visit Isle of Wight says additional content, even details, campaign updates and business opportunities will continue to be added to the website over time. Businesses are being encouraged to explore the new platform and learn more about the support available through the Wight BID.
Isle of Wight NHS team wins Digital Transformation Award for Major Pathology Upgrade. From Isle of Wight Radio. A project team involving the Isle of Wight NHS Trust has been recognised with a major regional award after delivering a significant digital transformation programme across healthcare services. The pathology LIMS project teams at the Isle of Wight NHS Trust and Portsmouth Hospitals University NHS Trust picked up the Digital Transformation of the Year Award at the Southeast Digital Skills Development Network Awards 2026. The award was presented during last month's Southeast Connect conference at Epsom Downs Racecourse. It celebrates innovation and impact in digital healthcare across the Southeast. The winning project introduced a new laboratory information management system, LIMS, replacing an older system with a modern digital platform, which is designed to improve the way pathology information is managed and shared. The new system went live on the Isle of Wight in June last year and at Portsmouth it last year in November, supporting more than 430 pathology users across both trusts. NHS leaders say the transformation has improved patient safety, reduced manual processes, and strengthened infection control reporting. It's also helped clinicians access pathology data more efficiently, allowing earlier decision-making and reducing unnecessary duplication of tests. Working through the Southern Counties network, the system enables healthcare teams across organisations to view pathology results more easily, helping improve patient care pathways. Judges praise the project's scale, technical delivery and collaborative approach, while also recognising its potential to be used elsewhere in the NHS. Josh Cliff, a Chief Digital Officer at the Isle of Wight NHS Trust and Portsmouth Hospitals University NHS Trust, said, "This award reflects the dedication and collaboration of everyone involved. The LIMS programme has delivered real benefits for patients and staff while creating a resilient digital platform for the future." The Southeast Digital Awards recognise individuals and teams helping shape the future of digital healthcare through innovation that improves services for patients and staff.
Hello, this is Madeline.
And this is Gerard.
And we're reading the second part of Talking News. Relief as man who has dementia spared move. An elderly islander faced with an unwanted move away from his family to the mainland has been given a reprieve, for now at least. The family of David Cleaver from St Helens received a call from St Mary's Hospital last Thursday, May the 14th, telling them he will not be moved to Horsham as planned. It came less than 24 hours after the county press published his story online. Lucy Ballard, David's niece, thanked the county press, and she said she believes our coverage, as well as our pressure from Isle of Wight East MP Joe Robertson, led to the change in her uncle's case. David has been in hospital since April the 7th, after falling and breaking his hip. He could not be discharged home because of the stairs there, but a lack of available space meant he could not go to care home here. David, who also has dementia, has told he could be moved to Horsham, and his family feared he could be left to die alone with no family around him. Lucy said she has been told he is not going to be moved to Horsham now because he has a fracture clinic outpatient appointment next week. Going forward, she was told he will stay in hospital for now and efforts will be made to get him on the waiting list for the new Lakeview care home opening at Blackwater. She said, "Absolutely, it is a relief. I can't see them shifting him off the island now. They've had this hoo-ha." She said, "Hopefully they have stirred up a bit of a hornet's nest, so that the issue of a patient's and care home residence being moved to the mainland, as highlighted by the county press, can be looked at seriously." Have you got a story for the county press? Contact the team in Newport via email at editor@iwcp.co.uk or call 01983 259003.
King queries pass dispute. The King has been informed that the ongoing row over a proposed section of the King Charles III England Coast Path, and reportedly questioned why English Heritage is opposing the Osborne part of the route. Kate Asbrook, Vice President of the Ramblers and General Secretary of the Open Spaces Society, raised the issue with the King during the official inauguration of the 2,700-mile National Trail. At some point, there was a hush, so I took the opportunity to explain to the King that although the pass was brilliant, there was a problem on the Alouette, she said. This concerned his family, since his great-great-grandfather had given Osborne to the nation, and now it was proposed to prevent us from enjoying a route near the beach, instead sending us inland on a disastrous road. The dispute centers on the unresolved Iskows to Wootton Bridge stretch of the coast path, which includes Osborne House and Barton Wood. Natural England originally proposed a seafront route running from Norris Wood past Osborne Beach and through Barton Wood. However, English Heritage, which manages Queen Victoria's former seaside residence, has long opposed public access through the estate, citing conservation concerns and a security risk to Queen Victoria's irreplaceable collection. As a result, National England has proposed an inland diversion along A3021 and York Avenue, taking walkers away from the shoreline for several miles. Ms. Ashbrook said the King queried why English Heritage was hostile to a coastal route, adding she told him it was because of fears that people might nip up the hill and steal the royal collection. She said she also made clear the King was not responsible for the decision, which was a relief to him. Isle of Wight ramblers have repeatedly criticized the proposed inland route, describing it as unpleasant and dangerous, and arguing it goes against the principle of a national coast path. 9 out of 10 sections of the island's coast path have now been approved, but the Osborne and Barton stretch remains unresolved and has been referred to the Planning Inspectorate to determine the next steps.
Council's apology for late leaflet. Islanders frustrated by delays to a long-awaited bin collection leaflet have prompted an apology from the Isle of Wight Council. The county press put questions to the local authority after residents complained to us and on social media that the new waste and recycling pamphlet for 2026-2027 had not yet arrived. In response, the council confirmed the calendars will be delivered to homes throughout June, acknowledging there had been an unforeseen delay to distribution. Residents had raised concerns about missing the key information, but the council has stressed there are no changes to collection days for the year ahead. While awaiting delivery, islanders can check their schedules online by entering their postcode via the council's website. The printed calendar includes essential information such as a full annual collection schedule, details about local waste and recycling services, and guidance on booking additional services, including reuse collections. Residents who have not received their calendar by July the 8th can contact council to request a copy.
Complaint that toilet for the disabled is open to all. Sandown Town Council has faced a complaint over its accessible toilet in Eastern Gardens. A member of the public expressed concern that the facility is available to all instead of being restricted by radar key access, arguing this may result in disabled people having to wait to use toilet designed to meet their needs. The complaint was brought up at a Sandown Council committee meeting on Monday. It said standard toilets do not provide the same accessibility features such as grab rails or sufficient space for wheelchair users. Royal Association for Disability and Rehabilitation, that is RADAR, keys open more than 10,000 disabled toilets across the UK, according to the Motability Scheme. Councillor Paddy Lightfoot tabled a successful proposal for the Sandown Town Council not to uphold the complaint, telling the meeting they were complying with the law and guidance on the issue. The complainant can still appeal through the local government and social care ombudsman watchdog, Sandown Mayor Alex Lightfoot said. If the complaint is specifically about discrimination or a failure to make reasonable adjustments under the Equality Act, legal enforcement against the council could be taken through the courts, he added. The complaint requested access be limited to RADAR key, due to disabled users typically having access to only one suitable toilet facility, while able-bodied users have multiple alternatives, Councillor Lightfoot said. Reading up points from the clerk's response to the complaint, he said, under the Equality Act of 2010, service providers, including councils, must ensure that disabled people are not placed at substantial disadvantage when accessing public facilities. This includes toilets. However, the Act does not require disabled toilets to be restricted exclusively to RADAR key users, nor does it prevent them from being available to the general public. Restricting access can itself create barriers, particularly for people with hidden disabilities, carers, or others who may not have a RADAR key but still require accessible features. Mayor Lightfoot said he was happy with the clerk's response, despite the complainant being unhappy with it.
Brave Ronnie 5 recovering after horror crash. A 5-year-old who was injured in a collision in Wroxall on Wednesday morning is recovering in hospital. Brave Ronnie Barrier is pictured smiling from his hospital bed after a horror crash on his way to school. The 5-year-old's bike collided with a taxi in Wroxall, causing the closure of the main road through the village for several hours. Ronnie's dad, Lloyd, said it was an accident and no one was at fault. "My little soldier is being strong," said Lloyd. "Thank you all for your kind words." Ronnie has sustained a severe broken leg and is expected to recover in around 6 to 8 weeks. Police and paramedics were called at around 8:30 a.m. to reports of a collision on St John's Road near the junction with Coombe Park. A cordon was erected for a time, blocking vehicle and pedestrian access. An air ambulance airlifted Ronnie to the mainland for treatment. Ronnie is a pupil at Wroxall Primary School.
Alarming levels of chemicals. New research has found the presence of forever chemicals in the solent to be at alarming levels, leading to scientists to call for further government intervention. A new paper published by a partnership of the University of Portsmouth and the Marine Conservation Society has detailed the presence of toxic and polyfluoroalkyl alkyl substances, PFAS, in the stretch of water between the island and the mainland. Nicknamed forever chemicals, PFAS chemicals are used in everyday products that are extremely resistant to breaking down. The chemicals have been linked to immune system disruption, liver damage, and certain cancers in humans and wildlife. An Alawat Council spokesperson said, regulation of water quality and discharges to rivers and coastal area is a responsibility of the Environment Agency, and the local authority has not been notified of a bathing water concern. A spokesman said, PFAS are a group of emerging contaminants, and national bodies continue to assess the evidence base and risks associated with them. We will continue to engage with the relevant authorities and review any guidance issued. The team collected samples examining surface water, sediments, treated wastewater, and marine life, and found evidence of PFAS of multiple levels of the solvent. Academics used a comprehensive method of recording toxicity and found the majority of species sampled exceeded the legal health benchmark. One of the most tightly regulated compounds, PFOS, exceeded the legal safety limited by more than 13 times in the sampling sites. The paper also found two southern water treatment plants in Portsmouth and Fareham were releasing a wide range of forever chemicals into the environment, and mapped sites where PFAS could be feeding into the solvent. The authors of the research are now calling for further regulation and intervention. A Southern Water spokesperson said, tackling the presence of these chemicals is a challenge for society as a whole. While we are investing heavily in cutting storm overflows and are removing more and more contaminants through wastewater treatment, the most sustainable solution is to meet the problem at source by changing legislation to restrict or ban certain chemicals and keep them out of pipes and the environment in the first place. A spokesman for DEFRA said, the persistent nature of forever chemicals poses a long-term challenge for the nation's ecosystems and health. The first ever PFAS plan shows the decisive action we are taking to better understand and tackle the sources of these chemicals, including in England's estuaries and coastal waters. Through better guidance and monitoring, tougher rules on their use, and support for transitioning to safer alternatives, the Environmental Agency has been contacted for a statement.
Council set to choose its new leader. The new leader of the Isle of Wight Council will be elected at a crucial meeting next week. On Wednesday, May the 27th, full council is due to vote on who takes over from Phil Jordan, who led the local authority from September 2023 until being ousted from his Ryde North West seat by Reform UK in the local elections earlier this month. The responsibilities of the leader include ensuring effective decision making, being the key contact for outside organisations, and being the representative voice of the council in, for example, its relations with central government. Other key decisions tabled for the forum include electing a deputy leader and council chair and deciding on a review of County Hall's constitution, including the creation of a standards committee. Introducing a standards committee was one recommendation from the Penn Report, a damning independent review which previously described the council as dysfunctional. Reform UK is now the biggest voting bloc in the chamber with 19 councillors. The party's group leader is newly elected Central Rural Councillor James Whelan. Councillor Whelan has yet to respond to a request for comment regarding his new position. There are also 11 independent councillors, 4 Liberal Democrats, 2 Conservatives, 2 Greens and 1 Labour member.
Business concern. We have more empty shops than a year ago. We've got more empty shops in Ryde than we had a year ago. That should concern us, Ryde Town Council heard last week. The public body asked on the 12th of May how it communicates with Ryde's business community and residents by a member of the public. Paul Wyatt, who suggested creating a panel to find out what firms are up against. He said, Ryde Town Council, the town, must have a vibrant centre, attract new enterprise and protect existing businesses. On the 15th of May, Chair of the Ryde Neighbourhood Board, Stephen Holbrook, said his independent partnership is keen to work with local businesses and pointed to the launching of new initiative, We Love Ryde. Mr. Wyatt said, how does Ryde Town Council communicate with the business community and residents? We were told that the town hall was setting up a new Ryde Business Association. To my knowledge, nothing has happened, which is very sad. I would have thought by now we would set up a committee to start making inroads into finding out what businesses or up against, what ideas they've got. It looks like the town board is not coming up with anything. We've got more empty shops in Ryde than we had a year ago. That should concern us. Outgoing Ryde Mayor Diana Conyers responded, I take your point entirely. You're right. That part of the problem has been not knowing quite what the neighbourhood board is going to do. Before the board came into existence and there was a business association here, there was a representative from an association that attended town council meetings, and we did engage with him for quite a while. It's all in limbo. Let's hope we get something coming up. The Ryde Town Council was set up as part of the government's plan for neighbourhood, renamed the Pride in Place programme. Earlier this year, the board unveiled a vision to invest 19.5 million of Whitehall funding in Ryde. County Hall acts as the accountable body for the RNB. Mr. Holbrook said, RNB is keen to work with local businesses and we are launching a new initiative, We Love Ryde, to help us do that. Created in response to public feedback and following an open process, We Love Ryde will promote and represent local businesses and help them engage with the board. We want businesses at the heart of future decisions. So please get in touch with your ideas. He said a community grant scheme offering up to £100,000 will support local projects.
VE Day celebrations spark wartime memories. Wartime memories were brought to life as care home residents marked VE Day with song, stories and a day of celebration. Old Charlton House in Cowes transformed its home with union flags and handmade decorations earlier this month. Residents, most of whom were children during the Second World War, shared heartwarming stories from the era. For some, wartime danger was hidden behind childhood excitement, and memories of finding ordnance were recalled as thrilling rather than frightening. One resident, Betty, shared that she thought her father was simply going to work each day, only to learn later in life that he was a code breaker at Bletchley Park. Another, Frank, remembered that Carisbrook High Street was a mass of union flags and drunk people. Colin and Jim, residents with naval engineering backgrounds, visited the White Military and Heritage Museum in Northwood as part of the celebrations. Jim served as a fleet officer engineer, while Colin worked on both Royal and Merchant Navy ships, maintaining blowers and generators in the boiler rooms. The pair reflected on the powerful guns and thick metal of the tanks on display. An afternoon music set was performed by the 1940-style duo Double Take.
Care home told it must improve. A care home for older people, including those living with dementia, has been told it requires improvement and was in breach of legal regulation relating to governance. The Care Quality Commission, CQC, concluded the Fairhaven Care Home in Ryde is not performing as well as it should after a recent assessment, with inspectors noting governance and oversight systems were not always effective. At the time of the inspection, 19 people were living in the service, which is provided and run by Ocray Care, Fairhaven Limited. Fairhaven was rated requires improvement overall, and for the CQC's safe and well-led categories. Three areas, effective, caring and responsive, were deemed to be good. The report said leaders did not always have the skills, knowledge, experience and credibility to lead effectively, or they did not always do so with integrity, openness and honesty. Audits failed to identify the risks we found at this assessment in relation to the environment, infection control and safe medicine management, inspectors said. These issues were discussed with the provider and management team, and they agreed to take immediate action. The CQC said it found shortfalls in the safe management of risks relating to fire safety, citing holes in some fire doors, excessive gaps around doors, and doors that were not fire rated. On the plus side, the report said staff showed an understanding of individual needs, respecting preferences, promoting independence, and engaging people in meaningful activities. It also said safeguarding, infection prevention, and control systems were generally understood, and people reported feeling safe. Other positives included good feedback from people, relatives and staff, and kind and caring interactions between people and staff. Ocre Care was approached for comment last Thursday morning, but has so far declined.
council interested in plans for ice or ice rink sites. Multi-million pound plans to redevelop the Isle of Wight's former ice rink may be brought before Ryde Town Council for discussion. Ryde, Apley and Elmfield representative Michael Lilly asked the RTC on May the 12th if it can make contact with the prospective buyers of Ryde Arena. A group has set out proposals to bring leisure facilities to the currently derelict building, which is on the verge of being sold to them. Councillor Lilly said, "Ryde Arena is extremely important. It's been an eyesore for a lot of years on the seafront. We've now, through the press, been told there is a proposal. Is it possible that as a council we can make contact with the people who are developing so that they can come and talk to this forum to speak about it? It would be good to have the relevant officer with the Isle of Wight Council dealing with that now. Obviously, there's a change of leadership in the council at the moment. It is important for us. I think the relevant officer would be Alex Minns, that we do have involvement about what is happening." Newly elected Ryde Mayor Karen Lucioni said RTC clerk Lisa Dyer will make contact with Mr. Minns, Service Director for Community, Regeneration and Economy at County Hall. Councillor Pippa Haywood said she wholeheartedly supported Councillor Lilly's comments and added it was really important as much as possible that the Town Council looks at bringing coherence to the seafront. Ryde Arena closed in 2016. Its freehold is owned by the Isle of Wight Council, but since 2014, the lease has been in the hands of AEW. Councillor Lilly told the local democracy reporting service, "I am the chair of a small charity, Ryde Community Development Trust, formerly Wight Leisure Centre, which was established out of the Ryde Arena campaign group. The ice rink was extremely important to Ryde, and RCDT has a principal aim of seeing the arena preferably back as an ice rink. But if that cannot be achieved, then at least a sport and leisure centre. There is a new Ryde forum of local sports groups, and there is a real need for an indoor sports arena, and we are keen to work with new owners. Ryde needs a thriving esplanade and not an eyesore of an empty building, so RTC needs to get behind this proposal."
Yellow heat guidance is to be issued. A yellow heat health warning has been issued on the Isle of Wight, prompting guidance to be issued by the UK Health and Security Agency. The warning, which begins at 9 a.m. on Friday the 22nd of May and currently ends at 5 p.m. on Wednesday the 27th of May, is of low impact and medium likelihood. Minor impact is expected across health and social services, and the heat poses a greater risk to life for vulnerable people. NHS guidance for heat waves suggests for people to keep out of the heat if possible, to wear sunscreen and to cool yourself down through cold food and drinks. Yellow heat health warning guidance suggests for people to stay in the shade and wear a sun hat if outdoors. Keep homes cool by shading windows during the day and opening them at night. Staying hydrated and avoiding alcohol and caffeine, and hold an awareness of signs of heat exhaustion or heat stroke. The Isle of Wight Council said to check in on elderly, isolated, ill or very young individuals and ensure they are staying cool and hydrated.
And now we're moving on to some white memories and nostalgia. Woman who became First Lady of Marine Engineering. The First Lady of the Institute of Naval Architecture, Blanche Thornycroft, was born in London in 1873, one of four sisters and two brothers. Both brothers and Blanche joined the family business of Thornycroft & Co. The boat business, which then had its home in Chiswick on the banks of the Thames, had been formed by her father in 1866. The family also had a home, Stainwood House at Bembridge, where scaled models of boat hulls could be tested in a pond. In 1909, John I. Thornycroft purchased land nearby Stainwood House and commissioned the design and building of a new purpose-built indoor test tank, which was finished in 1910. Although she had no formal education, Blanche became important in her position as assistant to her father. It was not until 1919 that the Institute of Naval Architects allowed the admission of women into its ranks. This is when John I. Thornycroft submitted a cheque on behalf of his daughter Blanche, and by May the 19th, her diploma of membership had been received, making her the first ever woman member of the Institute. Blanche proved to be a valuable asset to her father, but preferred to shun professional meetings of the National Institute and other professional bodies, preferring to work alone. Eventually, following the firm's relocation to Woolston near Southampton, Stainwood House in Bembridge took a more prominent role in marine testing of vessels. Blanche took part in the testing and trials of many of the classic Thornycroft boats. Some of her important work involved developments incorporating some of her designs in the production of the Thornycroft high-speed water skimming craft, and some of her designs were used during the Second World War by the RAF rescue boats, fast torpedo boats, destroyers and fast racing boats. At some point in her career, she even experimented with hydroponics, that's growing plants in water.
But it was in the field of marine architecture that she achieved a name for herself. As previously mentioned, much of the experimental work and calculations were carried out at the family home in Bembridge and nearby purchased land in Steen Woods, which eventually took a more important role in all future developments. One early testing facility at the family home was called the Lily Pond. It was disguised, possibly for security purpose, as a lily pond, but was in fact a water vessel testing tent. Later, a large brick indoor testing tank was built on the Steen Wood site. Throughout her career, Blanche kept meticulous records of her work, leaving a detailed and important legacy of information. During the First World War, some of Blanche's engineering skills involved development of moorings for explosive mines and a unique high-speed propeller which enabled a craft to jump cables. She was also active within the Bembridge community, where she helped in founding the Bembridge Nursing Association. Blanche lived in Bembridge all of her life and never married, living to 1951. Today, many of the Steen Wood facilities are classed as historic heritage buildings and by pre-arrangement can be viewed.
Now, my view from Jane Stevenson, columnist. Fixed link versus ferries. Be careful what you wish for. The price of ferry travel to the Isle of Wight has been a source of constant comment in the press and on social media sites for a long time. Letters and comments cite the price of crossing the water as the reason for the downturn in visitor numbers, the rising cost of basic commodities on the island, and the unjust costs of travelling for healthcare. Additionally, it is limiting when attempting to purchase certain items due to the extortionate delivery costs quoted by some carriers. Both ferry companies serving the island are owned by investment companies who are duty-bound to consider their shareholders who expect a return for their money, so funds have to be found to pay dividends. Yet the ferries themselves are in dire need of cash. With an ageing fleet, the frequent maintenance requirements of the boats and upgrades to the basic terminal facilities. Cost is also affected by the introduction of the emissions trading scheme and higher fuel prices due to the international situation. On the island, the questions of building tunnels or bridges as mainland links is often mooted as a solution to the problem. All I'll say is, be careful what you wish for. Such large-scale structural changes bring their own set of problems. As an example, the Dartford Crossing links Kent to the rest of the UK via Essex. It spans 1.8 miles and was estimated in 1986 at a cost of £86 million. At its opening in 1991, that cost had risen to £120 million. Despite the tolls having repaid the funding, motorists are still subject to a fee for each journey, although I understand Dartford residents can pay a reduced fee if they are registered to do so.
While I have sympathy for the build a bridge, dig a tunnel hobby, I think we should proceed with some caution. After all, such plans were put forward back in the 19th century, yet for a number of reasons, no feasible solution has materialized. Any fixed link to the island requires an acceptance from the residents that the island, as we know it, will fundamentally change. The sheer logistics of any project include geological surveys, safety measures, a major rethink of our road and rail system, and possible resettlement of homes. Indeed, any bridge or tunnel will need to extend several hundred meters inland on both sides, merely to allow for heights or depth gradients. Work is likely to take many years and many millions of pounds to implement. Neither option is a quick fix. Would we, as islanders, be asked to contribute towards the costs of such an undertaking? Not everyone travels to the mainland. If it was privately financed, would toll fees be a requirement for travel? Who decides on a pricing scale? Yes, the ferries are ridiculously expensive, but we must examine all options carefully, including challenging the ferry companies, rather than assume a bridge or tunnel will solve everything.
Now for some public information from James Potter, the Isle of Wight Trading Standards. Beware the pitfalls of being a trader. Whether you are a trader or a customer, it is easy to assume that using brand names, logos, images, or music is harmless, especially in a world of social media, online marketplaces, and craft fairs. As a trading standards officer, I regularly see small businesses and well-meaning consumers caught out by misunderstandings about intellectual property. Knowing the basics can help traders avoid costly mistakes and help customers understand what they are really buying. Intellectual property law exists to protect creativity, reputation, and consumer trust. In the UK, two key laws apply to everyday trading: the Trademarks Act 1984 and the Copyright Designs and Patents Act 1988. These laws apply just as much to a sole trader selling online or at a market stall as they do to high street names. Trademarks, more than just big brands. A trademark protects a brand's identity. This can include names, logos, slogans, characters, and even distinctive packaging or shapes. If a trademark is registered, only the owner has the right to decide how it is used. For traders, the rule is simple: do not use a brand name, logo, or character if it could make customers think your product is linked to, approved by, or connected with another business. Describing items as branded, inspired by, or Disney style, or adding a logo to personalise a product can still mislead consumers and may amount to infringement. It is a criminal offence to sell, make, customise, store, or offer for sale goods bearing a registered trademark without permission. Even if the items are handmade, produced in small quantities, sold only online, or made at a customer's request, telling a buyer that something is not genuine does not make it legal. Copyright automatic protection. Copyright is slightly different. There is no registration system in the UK. Protection arises automatically as soon as an original work is created. This includes photographs, artwork, illustrations, written content, designs, music, videos, and characters from films, television, books, or games. This is particularly important online. Images found on Google, social media posts, popular songs, and digital graphics are not free to use just because they are easy to copy or share.
Reposting someone else's photo to promote your business, using a chart-topping song in a video, or copying another trader's design without permission can all infringe copyright. Crediting the creator is polite, but it does not replace the need for consent or a license. Common misconceptions. Traders often say, "It's handmade, so it's allowed. I only sold a few. I did not know it was protected. Everyone else sells it. The customer asked me to make it." Unfortunately, intent, skill, or lack of knowledge do not prevent an offense. The legal responsibility still applies. The consequences. Getting this wrong can have real consequences. Complaints from rights holders, takedown of online listings, loss of social media accounts, removal from markets or events, and in some cases, legal action or seizure of goods. Do's and don'ts. Do create and sell your own original design. Do use license or genuinely royalty-free images and music. Do keep written permission or license agreements. Do check suppliers carefully before buying branded goods. Don't use logos, characters, or images that belong to others without permission. Don't copy designs seen online or at markets. Don't assume social media content is free to use. A good rule of thumb for traders and consumers alike is this. If it is not yours and you don't have permission, it probably should not be used or sold. Respecting intellectual property protects businesses, supports genuine creativity, and helps consumers buy with confidence.
Now we have some things that are going on. From the 28th to the 31st of May at 7:30 p.m., Shanklin Theatre hosts The Scarlet Pimpernel, a stunning musical set in the French Revolution. Enjoyed Les Miserables? You'll love the music drama, comedy and sword fighting. Shanklin Theatre, Prospect Road. And you can book tickets, which are £23, at 077-477-38338.
A celebration of all things Lambretta takes place at Wright Pavilion over this weekend, May 23rd to 24th. The 25th anniversary event will include live music, a beer tent and barbecue, competitions and a ride out. Acts include Maximum Who, The Tornadoes, Bootleg Beatles and Wham 69. Ticket cost £12 for the day or £20 for the weekend. Bembridge Street Fair. More than 100 stalls will be at Bembridge Street Fair on the Upper High Street on Monday the 25th of May from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Live music and entertainment, food and drink, road closures, free car park and ride. The Medina Marching Band will mark its 50th anniversary with a spectacular tattoo at Cowes Enterprise College on the 24th of May. Starting at 6 p.m., the event features youth marching bands and drill teams from across the UK, culminating in a massed band. Ticket costs £12. Goddard's Brewery will host a vintage tractor and steam weekender on the 23rd and 24th of May, featuring classic vehicles, family activities, and live music. The event supports Mountbatten Aloe White with a charity stall on site. Visitors can enjoy food, drinks, and voting for the best tractor and stationary engine.
The Gatcombe and Chillerton Scarecrow Festival starts tomorrow, Saturday, and continues until next Sunday, May 31st, with more than 100 scarecrows on show around the village. Live music takes place tomorrow, noon to 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Sunday, noon to 4 p.m. and Saturday, May the 30th, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Aunt Sally's Tea Room is open daily in the Village Hall, 10:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. with scarecrow maps available from the Gallybagger Inn and Village Hall. Carisbrook Open Gardens. Carisbrook Open Gardens takes place on Sunday, May the 24th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. with six gardens and an ancient church visit. There will be plant stalls and refreshments. Tickets cost £5, available from 10:30 a.m. at Carisbrook Village Hall and the Health Centre, where free parking is available.
Abbey's Monks take exhibition to London. Last summer, an exhibition of reproductions from the National Gallery that showcased the life of Mary, Mother of Christ, was held at Quarry Abbey, organised by Friends of Quarry. Father Dominic Robinson, senior Jesuit of the Catholic Church in Mayfair, commonly known as Farm Street, was visiting Quor then and invited the monks to bring the exhibition to his church. And so this month's exhibition of 24 paintings hang in their gallery. It was launched with a well-attended evening of antiphons, chants and poetry by Edmund Matiasek, also of the island, who held a residency last summer to read poems from his new book on the feasts of Mary, and is doing the same this month in London. There was a representative of the Pope's diplomat in England, the papal nuncio, in attendance. The exhibition hangs in Farm Street until the end of May, and there is another exhibition on related themes at Quor this July and August. Edmund said, Quor has truly now come to London in style.
Now some letters to the editor. Politics gets stranger still, from Hans Bromwich in Cowes. Dear editor, can our world get any more bizarre? After the drubbing Labour received in the recent elections, Keir Starmer promises a stronger, fairer Britain, whilst announcing he was appointing Gordon Brown a special envoy on global finance. The man who not only sold off Britain's gold, but stupidly announced he was going to do so to the world. We now have Wes Streeting, Peter Mandelson's protege, declaring he wants to take Britain back into the EU. Has anyone asked the EU if they would like us back? It certainly wouldn't be on anything like the terms we had before, where illegal immigrants could be sent back. How much would it cost? Remember, we haven't any money, and why would Europe entertain such an idea, only for the count of dodgy crypto to take us back out again a few years later? Where is all this nonsense coming from, you might ask? I'll tell you, the Tony Blair Institute, who are not only desperate for us to rejoin Europe, but also want to impose digital ID or Orwellian idea that's already being roundly rejected by the British public. Something that seems to have been conveniently forgotten by the Isle of Wight MP for West Wight, Richard Quigley, who has offered the island and its people up as guinea pigs without having the good grace to ask them first. Then there's Zach, who can't be bothered to get out of bed to vote for his own party, and Sir Ed, who was asleep at the wheel during the post office scandal. It doesn't exactly fill one with confidence. At least Kemi is calling things as she sees them, not that the Conservatives have a hope in hell of ever being re-elected.
Save Beefeater, a letter from Barry Carpenter of Newport. It was with total shock and dismay that I read your article about Whitbread's intention to close the Beefeater restaurant at Medina Quay, Newport. Such a lovely restaurant and a little gem within the community of Newport and the wider island. Surely this cannot be allowed to happen. I regularly dine at this restaurant, and so do a large number of island residents. It is very popular with families with children. The food is good, the prices are good, and the staff are so warm and friendly. The staff go out of their way to make your visit a positive experience and make you want to come back again, which we do time and time again. I have seen this restaurant grow in popularity over the past few years. They are always busy, and if you have not booked, you are unlikely to get seated. Breakfast, lunch, and evening meals are on offer. During the COVID pandemic, after lockdown, the local community went to Beefeater in droves under the Eat Out to Help Out scheme. You struggle to get a booking most days. The local community has really supported this restaurant since those dark days, and now to be told that it might close is devastating news. This restaurant and hotel is situated within the heart of the community at Cyclos Park. The local population outnumber the hotel guests at a ratio of 3-1. You regularly see tables of anything from 6 to 12 people in family groups there. They cater for weddings, funerals and birthdays, and works parties. The restaurant supports the operation of the Alouat Festival and a number of other local events that take place within the park and Newport Harbor. It is probably fair to say it is a jewel within the crown of Whitbread's restaurants. It is the local community. Is the local community just going to let this happen, or are we going to make our voices heard? Write to your local MP. Write to the Alouette Council. Write to Whitbread to voice your concerns and objections. If enough people do so, then we might be able to get Whitbread to reconsider their decision.
Worried about diners stroke drinkers, name and address of the person that was supplied. The bathhouse, formerly Toilet Block on Park Road Cows, is wholly within a residential situation and therefore in a new and uncharted scenario for a licensed premises, with nothing of its kind or similar anywhere nearby in immediate surroundings. This was forcefully stressed at the licensing hearing, but the licensing panel chose to ignore this as a novel and unusual individual setting for an alcohol license. There are traffic concerns in the immediate proximity, overlooking a five-way junction close to the town centre. Any cafe, restaurant, bar, extra, any cafe, restaurant, bar, extra traffic will exacerbate use of a very busy major junction, and a further added possibility of takeaway may equal increased use. Gridlock. An accident or two waiting to happen after day-long alcohol. An 11:30 p.m. closure daily is too late. Diners, drinkers, possibly noisy, wandering home very late through a solely residential area. Most neighbours have to get up early for work 5 days a week.
Minor tweaks. Last letter from Richard Eltringham, East Cowes. Red Funnel's new late night sailings are being sold as a bold step forwards, but the pattern is familiar. Operators unveil minor timetable tweaks as if we were acts of public generosity, while the island remains stuck with an inflexible overpriced system designed around their convenience, not ours. For years we have been told that meaningful change is too costly or complex to trial. Yet, when commercial interests align, services materialize overnight. The barrier has been logistics. It has been the operator's reluctance to disturb a comfortable status quo. What the island needs is the ability to run small, affordable feasibility studies for alternative community-led transport models. A simple fix for the planning and funding framework would allow this. Instead, we remain dependent on companies that innovate only when it suits them. That's the end of the news. It's goodbye from Gerard.
And goodbye from Madeline.
Hello. Later, in one of the most dramatic weeks of news in years, why have blind people been deprived of a major source of news?
When the service went down, there was no communication. So when people logged on, they got a very strange error message, which almost implied that it was their fault, that something was wrong at their end.
But first, earlier this year, the government set out its stall in a white paper for major improvements in the provision of services for children with special educational needs. More money was promised, and as far as visually impaired children were concerned, there was also an assurance that there'd be an increase in the number of QTVIs, or qualified teachers of visually impaired children. But anxieties have been expressed that with the government's emphasis on children wherever possible being educated in the mainstream, there is a danger that the benefits to blind and partially sighted children, which can be offered by schools specifically dedicated to their needs, may be overlooked. Well, now these concerns have been specifically addressed in a report just produced by Victor, the Visual Impairment Centre for Teaching and Research at Birmingham University. I've been joined by its author, Dr. Rachel Hewitt. What essentially, Dr. Hewitt, are you saying in this report? Spell out the worry.
Thanks, Peter. Well, firstly, I think it's really positive how the government has recognised that the SEND system isn't working. I think our concern is that the broad needs of children and young people with vision impairments might be overlooked in these reforms, particularly if there's too much responsibility given to schools without clear expectations to meet those needs. And we're also concerned about the lack of clarity about the role of specialist settings in delivering this.
You talk in the report about the problem of children with high needs but low incidence. Can you explain that and why the fact that the numbers are small should be a problem and why it would be a particular risk in mainstream education?
Yeah, I think just the way that education is set up, it's very much focused around exam results and qualifications, and those are the metrics that schools are often governed by. But when it comes to the education of children with vision impairments, we need to be thinking in broader terms about the skills that they're going to need, not just for accessing education, but also for life as well. And so education has a really important role in making sure that children and young people can develop those skills in a structured way throughout their educational journey so that they can meet their potential once they leave school.
So as far as that kind of rehabilitation, what are mainstream schools not providing at the moment, and in your view perhaps won't be in spite of the assurances contained in the white paper?
One of the biggest concerns that we have is the lack of rehabilitation specialist supports that children are able to access through their education. So reports by Thomas Buckland and Trust and Guide Dogs really highlighted how many children are going without that really important support. So by that I mean things like mobility skills, orientation skills, being able to do things around the house independently. Quite often this is seen as more of a social care type intervention, but actually the way that the system's set up, this is covered under education, and it's really important for their education outcomes and their long-term outcomes into adulthood.
Now, we did put some of these anxieties to the Minister of Children and Families, Josh McAllister, at the time, and especially the feeling that given the emphasis on mainstream, there was a sense of a rather dismissive attitude to special schools. This is what he said.
We want to strengthen special schools. We want to make sure more of their time is spent focusing on support for children, and that we want to make sure that there are tens of thousands of extra places in special schools, and the package of measures includes the funding.
Which has to go to the local authorities, because it's the local authorities who are saying we can't send your child to a special school because we haven't got the money.
Yep, so we're funding local authorities because they've got the responsibility for SEND provision, but we will be holding them to account to make sure they create that extra provision. So we're only giving them the money to pay for these extra SEND special school places, and we're expecting them to create that provision. Mm-hmm. We're also funding them to create provision in mainstream as well.
So they're saying there, Rachel, that there is going to be money and it is going to be directed towards special education. What do you say to that?
I think at the moment it's just there's a lack of clarity about what the role of special schools, and I guess it's worth making that distinction between special schools and also specialist schools. So we're thinking about schools that have a specialist remit for supporting children with vision impairments. And at present, it's just really not clear where they're going to fit in the government's strategy around the SEND reforms. And there's very, very little mention at the moment about how they plan to draw on specialist settings. So that leaves specialist settings like New College Worcester in a difficult position to kind of plan for the future.
Well, also joining me is Victoria Ward, who is Head of Visual Impairment Education at New College Worcester, which is, of course, a specialist school looking after visually impaired children. Victoria, New College Worcester was orchestrating the campaign for a greater recognition of the continuing need for special schools before this white paper and the list of reforms was announced. I mean, are you saying that the points you were making there have been ignored in this white paper?
I'm not sure that people really understand that a specialist provision is inclusive. I hear the word inclusion being used to describe mainstream provision, but true inclusion is more than that. It's about meaningful participation. Placing a child who is blind in a mainstream classroom without the proper support and accessible learning isn't true inclusion. It's quite the reverse. It's segregation. We provide at New College Worcester a peer group of other blind young people who can share experiences. And this has a very positive impact on a young person's mental health. I think mainstream schools do a fantastic job, but they lack the economies of scale to provide the immersive environment that a child can get at New College Worcester. And, you know, taking the example of Music Braille, that's my area as a music teacher. And it took me many, many years to learn. And it's simply not feasible for a mainstream music teacher to acquire this highly specialist knowledge when they might only encounter one Braillist in their whole career.
You're making an interesting point here, because surely the case for mainstreaming, wherever possible, is quite strong, given that growing up mixing with your sighted peers is surely a major element in being integrated in society as an adult, although you seem to be perhaps questioning what sounds to me like a logical assumption.
Specialist schools like ours, we don't oppose inclusion, we enable it. So we give our students a very intensive, specialised, you know, provision where they learn independent skills that they need to thrive in a sighted world. If we invest in their independence now, in the longer term, it will save the public purse millions of pounds in adult social care.
The problem for local authorities, and, you know, and this was the point that I was asking Josh McAllister about, but the problem for local authorities is cash, and schools like New College Worcester, they are expensive. What would you have wanted the government to do about that problem, which they haven't done? I mean, Josh McAllister says there is going to be more money for special schools. I guess your worry is that that will be spread quite thin.
Well, I completely reject the idea that giving a child who is blind an education, a holistic VI education, is an expensive luxury. What I'm asking for, firstly, is for the government to ring fence funding for low incidence sensory impairments and to look at this on a regional or national level, not a local council level. I understand local authorities are under immense financial pressure, but forcing them to absorb the costs of highly specialised equipment, resources and intensive staff training out of generic local budgets just simply doesn't work.
Let me go back finally to Rachel Hewitt. On that specific use of financing children to go to a special school, what do you think can be done? Because at the moment, the local authorities quite often simply say, we can't do it. And therefore, you know, the parents have to battle, not always successfully, to do it.
Something that we're really advocating for is the formal recognition of the curriculum framework for children and young people with vision impairments, which offers a new, more kind of collaborative approach between specialists and non-specialists, with everyone working together more effectively. And we hope that through this framework, which we're investigating the implementation of still, and we're hoping that that will promote some efficiencies in the way that specialists and non-specialists can work together, but at the same time improving the outcomes of children and young people through that holistic support that recognises the need to equip them to be independent in their learning.
Well, we shall see how it works out and how the money works out. Dr. Rachel Hewitt, Victoria Ward, thank you both very much indeed. Now, if you're a news junkie, it would be hard to think of a more eventful week, certainly in terms of domestic politics. So, particularly unfortunate that the RNIB's highly valued news agent service, providing national and local newspapers and many more magazines in an accessible form for blind and partially sighted people, should have chosen this moment to crash. No publications for 4 days, and even more concern to the people who've been contacting us about it, no explanation while this was going on about what was causing it or how long it was likely to last. One of those users that we've been talking to is Ian Lackey. Ian, the service is now back and there has been an apology and some explanation since from the RNIB. So just explain why you're still so concerned about it. You know, digital services do go down from time to time.
I think the thing that I'm concerned about, well, two things I'm concerned about, really. One is that when the service went down, there was no communication. So when people logged on, they got a very strange error message, which almost implied that it was their fault, that something was wrong at their end. But the second point is that basically the service needs some love, because for a while now, there have been magazines that haven't been updating. The TV and radio guides at one point weren't updating for a long time. And other magazines, the updating has been a bit sporadic. And I think that concerns me.
So what would you have liked the RNIB to have done?
I would have liked them to have said something along the lines of, we are having problems with the website at this point. We're working hard to get it fixed. And perhaps if they could give us some kind of indication as to how long it would take to get that fix in place.
We were very keen to get someone from the RNIB on the programme to discuss this with us and with you. But we were told that no one was available on this occasion. This is the statement they sent us.
Last weekend, RNIB became aware of an issue impacting on staff and customer access to the newsagent service. The disruption was caused by an internal IT configuration issue rather than any underlying fault with the newsagent service itself. Once the root cause of the problem was identified and fixed, service to customers was restored. We would like to apologise for any inconvenience caused and the delay in communicating to customers the impact on their services. We have contacted affected customers to provide an explanation and set out our commitment to continuing to deliver a service which we know is highly valued by its users. The way many people access news and information is changing, with an increase in different formats available. RNIB remains committed to supporting blind and partially sighted customers to keep up to date with the latest news through RNIB Newsagent, offering more than 200 popular and influential publications in accessible formats.
What's your reaction to that? Because they're making the point that it was an internal problem, as if that should be reassuring to us.
Well, it's not really, because I know that in the past there have been times when I think the newspapers have updated fairly regularly and properly, but there have been times when magazines, even some of their own magazines which they put up, like the radio and television guides, they haven't been updated for considerable periods of time. And I know, for example, that the last time of looking, the BBC History magazine The last issue of that that was showing was February. We're now in May. I'm not aware that that magazine has ceased publication.
So do you have longer term concerns about the service?
Yeah, I do. I know that a year or so ago, towards the end of 2024, a number of us were asked to pilot test a new updated website for the RNIB newsagents. We did the testing, we sent our feedback, and then we heard nothing, which I think is very disappointing. And RNIB themselves have admitted for a long time that the web offering is creaking to some extent. And we know, for example, that for a good period towards the beginning of this year, there were no audiobooks being added to the reading services website. And I think really what I would like to see is the newsagent site getting a bit of loving care and attention to make sure that these problems with updating the magazines happen less frequently than they do.
There was an interesting phrase in there where they said people's methods of accessing news were changing. Was there a code there in any way, you think?
And perhaps they're saying people don't read newspapers as much. So perhaps we don't need to spend so much effort on updating the site. I don't know. Maybe I'm putting words in their mouth. But I do know that for me and for many people, the newsagent site is one of the best values for money offerings that the RNIB gives us.
And for you, from a personal point of view, what would you say it gives you?
The big thing it gives, especially as I use the e-text version of the site, is it gives me the choice. You know, if you look on the website, there are lots of local newspapers, and a lot of people will get news via local newspapers and talking newspapers. But the thing about talking newspaper is that somebody else has made the choice as to what you get. When you get a newspaper from the RNIB website, you get the full text. So you decide what you want to read. And it's not somebody else deciding what you should hear.
So a very valued service as far as you're
concerned. Oh, very much so. Very much so.
Ian Lackey, thank you very much indeed.
And thank you.
Just to add, we've already had a large response to our interview that we did with the new RNIB CEO, Simon Antrobus, and we're expecting more. We will be reflecting this in the near future when we can give it the time it needs. As for today, well, we'd like to hear from you about anything you wanted to pick up from in this programme. Email in touch at bbc.co.uk, or you can leave a voice message on 0161 836 1338. From me, Peter White, and this week's producer, Fern Lullum, goodbye.
Scaffolding and Skips News for a week commencing 25th of May 2026. Newport area, 66 St. James Street, Mountbatten Shop Chain Lane, 39 Clifford Street.
In the Ryde area, 141 High Street, 77 George Street, Morrison's Daily Union Street, 52 Union Street, 5 Union Street, and 17 South Street.
Cowes and East Cowes area, 106 High Street, 15 to 16 Market Hill, The Parade Public Toilets, Bars Road, RMU Court, Bridge Road.
In the Ventnor area, Ventnor Youth Centre, Victoria Street, Rose Inn, Pier Street.
Sandown area, 52 Fitzroy Street, Ferncliff Pass, Sandown, Tis the Season, 16 St. John's Road, Old Town Hall, Brading, Alverstone Farmhouse, Main Road, Alverstone.
In the Ryde area, Skips, 14 Castle Street, 37 Quarry Road, and in Seaview, opposite the Seaview Beach Shop, High Street.
At Yarmouth area, Omdurman, South Street.
No, I,